This is question 10, going back. Question 10, you endured, I endured, plus worked freelance gigs and odd jobs, and extended post-production in Los Angeles, San Francisco, where Ferlinghetti saw a cut and lauded Book Wars as anarchistic, New York and New York again to revisit my fellow booksellers, then back to San Francisco to add sequences. That's not entirely the chronology, by the way. Anyway, to continue the question, as if that weren't enough, you, being me, drove to New York, which I didn't, I went back by plane, in order to complete the final edit. This must have been as grueling as the original shoot. It was, actually, still, that aggregate amount of movement was extremely grueling. Did the idea of framing the documentary within a man heading out west to start anew concept occur to me during these very long back and forth road trips, or was it there from the start? So I get this question is talking about the device of the road trip. Let me address the device first, the road trip, because it is driven by a narrator relating his experiences. I thought it would be appropriate to have some situation where a narrator would be talking to a friend or colleague or fellow traveler and sort of support that storytelling. And so then I thought, well, in what situation does a person elaborate on a long or a chapter of their life where they've just been and where they're going? And at that time, yes, I was doing a lot of ride shares as often as possible, but either road trips, leaving not just road trips for fun and being a bohemian, but actually going to work on the movie by road and or punctuated by trips with other people in the car, like through Craigslist or some other ride sharing board. That's how I got around for the majority of it. Why? Well, because it was cheap. And, you know, you share the driving and the gas, and naturally you get to talking. So that became the nominal, assumed format. That it was kind of an instinctive choice based on that. Let me address the first part of the question. I did work freelance gigs and odd jobs everywhere I went to make the movie because there was no funding. Although I really sought funding everywhere I went. I was down at the Foundation Center in San Francisco trying to get grants. I was in New York at the Association of Independent Video and Filmmakers trying to get grants. Everywhere I went in LA, I was working. I wasn't looking for grants there. Plus, it's less of a, what do you call it? Concentrated city, and I didn't know where the grant places were to look for grants. So that was a little arrest period where I wasn't looking for grants in LA. Here's the chronology, just to get it clear. I shot initial material in New York City at the book stand while I'm selling books, just as a lark. Then, by chance, ran into a colleague I know who works in documentary, Mr. Michel Negroponte, and we talked about it, and he mentioned and proposed the idea, well, why don't you formalize it into a documentary? I thought, well, hey, that could be an interesting thing to try. After that, because winter was coming anyway in New York, I decided, well, I will go back to New Mexico where I had worked before and I know some people there, and I'll use their tape-to-tape editing system to make an assembly edit of Book Wars. So the very first cut was done in Albuquerque, New Mexico. From there, I went to L.A. because I was closer to L.A. than New York. I went to L.A. because I needed to work, and New York was farther away, and it was winter. So, and a colleague of mine who was doing Hollywood stuff, music videos and commercials, encouraged me, you know, asked me to come on out there. There was a decent amount of work, not mind-blowing, but enough to get by while I probed for more options. While in L.A., through a friend, I made contact with the producers in San Francisco who had the nonlinear editing system I needed. I needed either an Avid or Media 100. This is in the era before Final Cut Pro, by the way. This is 1996, 1997. That's why I was moving to access the equipment. So then they agreed. They liked the cut. They liked the narration. So I went up to San Francisco because I couldn't viably commute from LA to San Francisco, I thought, and it turned out to be correct. I couldn't. So I went there, set up shop there, cut a lot, cut my tits off. And I don't mean literally cut my tits off editing-wise on the editing machine. Did odd jobs there. Was a pedicab driver on the wharf. Did temp jobs. Did little jobs, some editing jobs while I was there, some video editing too. So the usual sort of potpourri. Then, and while I was there, got the cut together to about 90% completion. At that time, just as I had landed that job at the startup in San Francisco and my life was getting comfortable again, the call came that a Media 100 system had become available through some mutual friends, colleagues of the then co-producer in New York, Michelle Negroponte. And I decided, after a lot of debate, well, okay, I'll go back to New York and finish it. It's got to be 100%, not 90%. I thought, and based upon the data I got from him, you know, and projections based on thinking that it would help propel the movie. So from San Francisco, I flew back to New York, shipped my stuff, and then went back to New York. That was the chronology. Anyway, there was still a lot of driving. For example, from New York to Albuquerque, as the winter was approaching, I packed up my stuff, stopped off in Ohio, where I grew up, and worked for a stint. This is while I'm gearing up to go to New Mexico. Worked for a stint. There was this guy who was in jail. I've never experienced this before. This guy who was in jail, but they let him out on work release each day, and he was a carpenter, and he was a decent guy. He was in jail for DWI. And I needed work, and this job came up, and I think no one else wanted it because the guy was, you know, quote unquote, in jail. He was a very soft-spoken, nice guy. He wasn't like a, you know, criminal, whatever that means. But it means that I went through this. It was starting to snow at that point while I was gathering money to get out to New Mexico. While it was snowing, I'd go out, pick him up from the county jail, and then as soon as we got out of the county jail, I don't know how he got it or had it, but he would take a bong hit. And then we'd head down to Cleveland to where he had these carpentry jobs lined up, and we'd go to these incredibly rough, weird neighborhoods I'd never been to when growing up and do these strange carpentry jobs. And I was basically the guy who picked him up from jail. And I assisted, but he was, you know, think of it from his point of view. He was happy to get out from jail each day and go and work. And it didn't matter. I could have been a fucking chimpanzee. but it so happened that, you know, I was the guy available to, and so we worked together. That's another story in itself. Anyway, that's what I did. That's an odd job I did while gearing up for the New Mexico leg of the Odyssey, if you want to call it that. Yeah, overall, it was grueling. Overall, there was a lot of travel. Looking back, it was completely not rational. The whole process, it wasn't like, I was driven by almost like a madness, I think, like a passion, not even coached on by any third party like the co-producer in New York or anyone else. It was at that point, as I started to shoot more, and it sort of took on a life of its own, and I felt driven to it. Here's what it is. I felt driven to get it to each subsequent step. I didn't feel driven to complete it as a released theatrical documentary or whatever, but I felt, for example, driven to get to New Mexico to make the assembly edit. And so each step had its own drive. I guess that's what made me go through. That's what enabled me to go through. Because if I had taken it en masse, as I do now, when I look back now, I say, I say to myself, how the fuck did I do that? How did that, that's, that movie should not have been made at all. I mean, it was, there was no funding. It was virtually impossible. The editing equipment was not available at the time. As we'll learn later, there were antagonists trying to interfere with the movie. It was grueling, yes. But I was driven by this, I guess it was a step-by-step thing. At each step, it became more and more tantalizing to go to the next step. So, for example, we did the assembly edit in Albuquerque and Super Bowl Sunday, I think that was 1996, with the crowd there and the way they reacted to it and the way the material played. And I realized, well, this is an interesting milieu. This is an interesting scene in the streets of New York. I didn't quite realize it because I was in it, working there within it. Let me see if I can take it a step further. And it's true. At the time, the co-producer in New York, Michelle, was giving me some sort of coaching feedback, but not, he wasn't really doing any heavy lifting. It was more like an occasional upbeat comment about how I should, you know, move forward or whatnot. But really, it was actually the movie, the material itself, that started to gain its own gravity, its own momentum. And that's what pulled it along. At the time, what was I, 28? Let's see, 26, 25. I was in my mid-20s when I was shooting it and starting to edit it. So you know how it is. In your mid-20s, anything goes. You can still afford to be a bit of a beatnik and live on couches and so forth. Unfortunately, I was still living on couches much later as a result of making the movie, and that was not fun at all. I'll get to that later. But when you're, you know, I was in my 20s, it was my first documentary, or it was my first ambitious project. I had done Charlie's Box, this drama beforehand, and it seemed like a suitable, bigger project to bite into, and it, as it started to gain momentum, I felt like floating with it and rolling with it, and it's easy to do that in your 20s. And I think it was released, it was finished when I was 30, so even then, you're still supple. Not hardened like I am now. And that's it, I guess, for number 10. The man heading out west to start a new concept. Actually, quickly going back to that, the device of the the road trip did come from my frequent road trips, either solo or with other, you know, rideshare people. But the man heading out west, well, that's an iconic American thing, North American thing, heading out west to start anew. And I had actually bought into that many times during my youth, going out west to have adventure. And it is actually, or it was at the time, looser and freer out west, especially in the Southwest and those big expanses, those giant, beautiful valleys and so forth. You know, when you cross the Mississippi, it's a great feeling. And when you cross the Mississippi for the first time, let's say you're doing your first road trip ever, or at least I'm looking back on my own, it was a fabulous feeling. And it does feel freer out there because, you know, I lived in New York about 10 years. I went to school there and slugged it out there doing projects and so forth. And it's a very compact, fast, vertical city. It's an eastern place, and it's different from the West. Now, what's funny is, now that I've lived in Asia for some time, the West in Asian mythology is viewed as the place of death. At the time, I didn't know that because I hadn't lived in Asia. I've lived in Asia off and on for about 10 years now, with trips back to the States. That's another story in itself. And a story or explanation. But the man heading out west, I didn't just, here's the short answer, I didn't just do it as a goofy gimmick. I did it because I actually had headed out west previously and experienced that flush feeling of freedom. So I injected that into the film as part of the device. I needed and wanted a storytelling device to justify the narration. Because I'm not really necessarily into first-person documentaries as much as some others are. There's a school of first-person documentaries where the filmmaker makes movies constantly about them and their own lives and talk about themselves a lot. And it can be interesting, I think, if you're fascinating to begin with. But a lot of the stuff I've seen, you know, even by my colleagues, they're not that fascinating of people. And so I didn't necessarily want to make a first-person documentary that featured myself incessantly. I wanted it, even though it was me, I wanted people to think, oh, it's the guy, it's the narrator. And in order to do that, I needed to create a device and wanted to create a device. And so I chose that. I guess it could have been something like a guy ascending in a hot air balloon with someone else and going somewhere else. But it happened to be the road because that was more appropriate. Oh, and let's not forget, that's how a lot of the book gathering was done in the later stages. You know, initially it was done by going to thrift stores and you know, little used bookshops and whatnot. Later on, when I got my first jalopy, it expanded my range, and that a lot of time was spent on the road going to get books. So getting the books, going, say, from New York, Manhattan to Ithaca, that was a big once-a-year sale up in Ithaca, and it was like legendary. You needed to drive from New York to Ithaca, which is not that far, really. It's still New York State, but it's a road trip. You need to stay overnight up there. I remember I stayed up there, and I slept in my car in a Polar sleeping bag because I had a station wagon, and I didn't want to spend money on a motel. It was really cold, though. Oh, and that's interesting. I remember now. I went from Ithaca. My family was up in Toronto because my mother's from England and my uncle lives up in Toronto. I remember I went from Ithaca one year straight up to Toronto by way of the Niagara Falls. And I'm parked next to Niagara Falls with this jalopy that either the one you see in the movie or another similar one, a Japanese station wagon, packed to the gills with really a nice haul of used books. Standing there at the rail looking out over the Horseshoe Falls. That was an amazing sort of moment. Anyway, yeah, so there's a lot of road trips involved in book selling too, at least according to the business model that I employed and that the folks I knew on Third Avenue, even Upper West Side and West 4th Street did. The guys on 6th Avenue were more into scavenging or flipping books and material much more quickly, so they didn't go out to find their stuff. They would wait for scavenger guys to come by and then flip the stuff quickly. Different business model. They didn't need a car. So anyway, that completely answers question 10. I hope.